There hadn't been enough guns, said another. Every teacher should be armed. A lack of family values was to blame, shouted the religious right. Still others claimed that the religious right had co-opted the community's mourning. Amid all this, people were trying to mourn the dead and heal the injured, while scrambling to rebuild a sense of community, a sense of safety, a sense of self. The natural response to tragedy is to look for meaning. How could this happen? Who is responsible? Tom and I were the chief suspects. Those boys could only have learned hate like that in their homes, editorials thundered. The things people wrote and said were painful to us, but we were far from the only ones to find the climate divisive. Like porcupines, people roll into a ball to protect their soft centers, projecting their spikes outward. This defensive mode is a natural response to being attacked, and there were a lot of spikes in Littleton in those days. The school, the media, the police, everyone involved seemed to be simultaneously fending off an attack while launching one of their own. The sheriff's department was doing meticulous work, but the public was learning they had also failed to follow through on Judy and Randy Brown's repeated warnings about Eric. His website was quoted extensively in the search warrants served on the day of the massacre, proving someone in the department had known about it. One claim had even been pursued. When investigators had found evidence that Eric was building pipe bombs, they drew up a warrant to search the Harris house. But the warrant was never taken before a judge, the house was never searched, and the investigation report did not surface until long after the tragedy. As the public lost confidence in the sheriff's department, people began to demand more information. The autopsy report of a minor is usually sealed, but the most important findings, that there had been no drugs in Dylan's system, for instance, had already been released. I did not see what anyone had to gain from knowing what was in his stomach when he died, or how much his organs weighed. Even with our lawyer's help, we lost that fight, and the autopsy results were picked over and published. I felt sick. Even in this, we had failed to protect Dylan. The media swarm had receded somewhat, but there was still a Columbine-related headline on the front page of the local news almost every day. Some reporters were digging into the ongoing investigation and trying to get a real understanding of the dynamics at the school. Others were less ethical. When Columbine crime scene photos of Eric and Dylan lying dead in pools of blood were sold to the National Enquirer and published, it seemed there was no line that couldn't be crossed. Later, though, I would learn that many journalists had also been traumatized by the time they spent in Littleton. Meanwhile, Tom and I were sitting in the eerily silent eye of the storm. Even while our own inner circle continued to be an immense source of strength and an insulation from the hostility of the outside world, the tension in our own relationship was rising. It would only get worse as the sense of solace and purpose I found in the company of other suicide loss survivors grew. My friend Sharon was a survivor of suicide loss herself and knew I needed to connect with other parents who had lost children to suicide. She also knew that my organizational skills made me a natural coordinator and administrator, the type of person you automatically ask to plan a meeting or balance a budget or type up minutes. So in that second year after Columbine, Sharon put me to work. She invited me to join a small group of women who volunteered for the Suicide Prevention Coalition of Colorado. Walking into the first meeting, I was scared sick. Would these people judge me? I didn't dare to hope they'd understand what Dylan had done, let alone what I had experienced. 10 minutes later, I was sitting around a kitchen table with five other mothers of children lost to suicide, tying raffia bows onto flower pots containing forget-me-not seed packets. There was no discrimination in that room, nothing but love and compassion and an all-too-recognizable grief. Three of the six women at the table, half, would also survive breast cancer, which strengthen my admittedly unscientific theory about what happens when a bomb goes off in your heart. The tension I usually felt in the company of others melted away. The opportunity to grieve for Dylan as my son, no matter what he had done in the final moments of his life, was valuable beyond description. I recently read an article in the New York Times by a therapist, Patrick O'Malley. He describes the respite one of his patients found at a support group for bereaved parents, despite her initial resistance. The group was a place where no acting was required. It was a place where people understood that they didn't really want to achieve closure after all. To do so would be to lose a piece of a sacred bond. When I was with other survivors, Dylan was a boy who had died by suicide. Nobody was excusing what he had done, but they weren't discounting my grief either, or my right to miss the son I had lost. The next weekend, I attended a luncheon hosted by the Suicide Prevention Coalition of Colorado, the group Sharon chaired. Our forget-me-nots were on the tables. For the first time, I was in a room filled with people who could relate to all my feelings, the ones that made me feel like I was hanging on to sanity by the merest thread. I didn't need to tell the people in that room that I hadn't known what Dylan was thinking or planning. That place was all too familiar to them. Bottom line, when someone lies to you, you feel like a fool, a woman said, and I startled myself with a ragged sob. One thing about a suicide loss survivor's event, you're never the only person crying. They understood the humiliation I felt at being duped, and the shame of knowing that I had not been able to help my child precisely when he had needed me most. As I'd done with Celia, I scrutinized everyone I met for some indication of the underlying problem that had brought this nightmare upon them. Did this mother seem cold or checked out? Did this dad seem abusive or neglectful? Was there some identifying characteristic that would brand these people, and by extension myself, as deficient in some way? This was, of course, the way people scrutinized me. But the people I met there were nice, smart, funny, kind, normal. Their stories poured out of them. They were elementary school teachers, social workers, truck drivers, dentists, pastors, stay-at-home moms. They had been active, attentive parents, sisters, husbands, wives, and children. They had deeply loved the person they lost. Like me, many of them had misread indicators of something drastically amiss. Suicide is ugly. It's wreathed in disgrace. It screams to the world that a person's life ended in failure. Most people don't even want to hear about it. As a culture, we believe that people who die by suicide are weak, that they lack willpower, that they've taken the coward's way out. We believe that they are selfish and have acted aggressively. If they cared about their families, spouses, work, they would have found a way to think themselves out of the spiral they were in. None of this is true, and yet the taint is pervasive and shared by the surviving families. Bewilderment, guilt, regret, and self-castigation are constant companions for a survivor of suicide loss. One afternoon, I had lunch with an old friend, not a suicide loss survivor, who asked me, "Can you ever forgive Dylan for what he did?" I sat silent, dumbstruck, seeing how radically our lives had diverged. All I could think of was the scene in Ordinary People where Buck's wet hand slips out of Conrad's and Buck drowns. I composed my thoughts so I could say what I felt without sounding defensive. Forgive Dylan? My work is to forgive myself. Like Buck, Dylan had slipped out of my grip. I was the one who let him down, not the other way around. If suicide is difficult to think and talk about, then murder-suicide is unthinkable. I hadn't simply failed to protect Dylan from himself, but everyone he killed, too. In the years I've been involved with the suicide loss survivor community, I have seen that education and prevention can save lives. but participating in that first event and in dozens of others since solidified a realization that was simultaneously comforting and terrifying. Anyone could be here. Lots of people there hadn't known there was a problem, or, like me, had underestimated its gravity. Our first inkling that something was seriously wrong slammed into our lives in one catastrophic, irreversible moment. Even professionals didn't always know when they were dealing with a life-and-death situation. A psychologist spoke about losing her son. Respected, well-trained, she'd known all the right things to do. Still, suicide hadn't even been on her radar. We should never conclude from these stories that suicide comes without warning, simply that we don't always recognize behaviors that may be indicative of risk. Others were well aware of danger, but hadn't known how to help. Another woman's son had been hospitalized repeatedly for his bipolar disorder. After his doctor recommended release, he continued to be treated. In fact, he saw both the family's pastor and his own psychiatrist on the day he shot his girlfriend and killed himself. These stories made me realize the seriousness of the foe we were up against. By lunchtime at the first event I attended, three things had become starkly clear. One, there is more to suicide prevention than loving someone and telling them so. As bottomless as my love had been, it had not been enough to save Dylan or his victims. And here was an auditorium filled with people who could say the same. Two, many of us had believed there were no signs of trouble on the horizon when we hadn't recognized indicators of potential risk. In many cases, we hadn't even known there was cause to be on heightened alert. Three, I learned that while there are effective interventions for depression and other risk factors for suicide, we cannot yet rely on their effectiveness. I'm hesitant to write that out of fear that someone who needs help might be discouraged from seeking it. But many of the people I met that day had tried to help someone struggling with ongoing or intermittent illness. They'd persevered through weeks, months, years, or even decades of therapy, through rounds of meds and alternative treatments and hospitalizations. Some of them were success stories, but some were not. Many lived in fear for someone else, or waged a daily struggle with their own suicidal thoughts. Whether the problem was finding a bed in a good facility, there is little consensus on whether hospitalization is the best treatment for suicidality at all. Some recent studies indicate that it may not be. The inadequacy of staff training on brain illness issues in emergency rooms, or a hospital's failure to raise an alarm about risk levels post-release, I understood for the first time that there were challenges to securing targeted, appropriate treatment for a person in danger. That first suicide prevention event was the dawning of a new awareness. The problem we were up against was multifaceted and tremendously complex. If something was going to change, there was a great deal to be done. Journal entry, May 2002. Suicide Prevention Summit, an emotional ride. Got hugged in elevator by people when I finally said who I was. There was lots of crying. I felt at home. To most people, it wouldn't have seemed like much. Me sitting at the registration table at a conference held by the Suicide Prevention Coalition of Colorado, greeting people and finding their name tags for them, as Celia had greeted me 2 years before. The difference was that I was wearing a name tag of my own, with a colored sticker on it, identifying me as someone who had lost a child to suicide. As I took my place at the table that morning, my heart hammered in my chest. Would I be caught off guard by someone from the press? Would an attendee realize who I was and spit in my face? I greeted the conference participants and answered questions about the speakers and gave directions to the restroom, and nobody said anything, except occasionally to offer condolences for my loss. After that watershed day, I became seriously involved in initiatives to prevent suicide and violence. I manned registration tables and folded programs. I joined thousands of others at community walks to raise money for suicide prevention. I shuttled presenters to restaurants from their hotels, packaged items for silent auctions, picked pamphlets up from the printer. I talked to people, I hugged them, and I listened. Recent data from the Centers for Disease Control show that suicide is among the top 10 causes of death in the United States, right up there with pernicious killers like diabetes, Alzheimer's, and kidney disease. But when it comes to funding for research, suicide prevention is at the bottom, perhaps because of the misguided and yet persistent belief that suicide happens by choice rather than illness. Funding for suicide prevention research comes largely from families who channel feelings of sorrow and helplessness into volunteering and fundraising. Like all nonprofit efforts, suicide prevention organizations are often underfunded and understaffed, and I quickly discovered that someone with my administrative skills could make a difference. For the first time in a long time, I felt I had a contribution to make. My motives weren't purely altruistic. Being part of a group working shoulder to shoulder toward the same goal was a gift I gave myself. Even if I couldn't officially attend a support group, I could link arms with other suicide loss survivors to make a good conference better. It was a privilege and a blessing to connect with a cause so deeply. I'd had many jobs and hobbies that I had cared about. I'd taught kids to read as a reading specialist, and I'd worked to provide adult students with disabilities the accommodations they needed to succeed in college. But my work in the suicide prevention community felt like a bona fide calling, a path out of the darkness, a way forward for a life that had careened off the rails. Over the years of working with people with disabilities, I had observed that profound loss often brought with it a depth of gratitude for life, a sense of joy, and an ability to be in the present that people untouched by tragedy could not always access. I felt that among suicide loss survivors, too. We cried a lot, but we also laughed. One told me, "You can't laugh and cry at the same time." Laughter, I found, helped me to recalibrate the gyroscope inside me that was swinging so wildly. I started to seek out Seinfeld reruns, Whose Line Is It Anyway?, movies to crack me up like the absurd spaghetti western parody They Call Me Trinity. I read books by humorists like Irma Bombeck, Dave Barry, and Bill Bryson. I listened to musical satirists like Weird Al and P.D.Q. Bach, as well as comedy on the radio during my commutes. Comedy became a form of community, too, as the best of it comes from a place of tragedy. Some of the comedians I came to enjoy the most, like Maria Bamford and Rob Delaney, speak openly about their own brain health struggles. Through other survivors of suicide loss, I learned to find compassion for those who judge me, too. One day, I heard through the grapevine that a colleague had been overheard saying, "You can't tell me a mother wouldn't know her child was dealing with something like this." It hurt because the woman and I had been friendly. To find out she believed I had known about Dylan's plans, that I had stood by idle while he planned to hurt himself and murder others, put me right back in the rock tumbler I'd been living in since Dylan's death. I couldn't stop perseverating about the comment, and mentioned it to a suicide loss survivor further along than I was. She nodded. "I used to think, if this happened in your family, you wouldn't judge. May life give you the opportunity to learn what a foolish and cruel thing you've said." Hearing her say that shocked me a little. I'd never seen her be anything but unfailingly generous and kind. She continued, "Of course, I wouldn't wish this on anyone. Anyway, they're only trying to convince themselves nothing like this could ever happen to them." We were in the parking lot by then, and she gestured to the box of suicide prevention pamphlets in the front seat of my car. "Ignorance is what we're out here to combat, right?" she said, shaking her head. "God knows, I didn't think it could happen to me either." Her comment helped me to realize why the suicide prevention community felt so much like a home. This is a grassroots movement made up of mothers and fathers and partners and daughters and sons. We donate our time because we believe our loved ones did not have to die, and we know firsthand that ignorance can be lethal. This lends a real sense of urgency to the work we do. In the aftermath of Dylan's death, I entertained hundreds of fantasies about ways to atone for what Dylan had done. Finally, here it was. I didn't have to trade my life in a terrorist attack to save the school bus filled with children. I could write a paragraph for a website, populate a spreadsheet, go around a ballroom putting programs on plates, pick a speaker up from the airport. The suicide loss community taught me that showing up in small and simple ways could save lives too. I read every book and article I could get my hands on. I worked conferences so I could hear the speakers. I struggled through academic papers I found online, even when the summary was the only part I could understand. I watched webinars, pored over educational resources, asked lecturers for their PowerPoint slides so I could make sure I hadn't missed anything. I asked as many questions as I could. Eventually, the suicide loss community helped me to see that it was Dylan's behavior, not mine, that had been pathological. In the process, though, I began to develop an activist's passion. What had happened with Dylan was an outlier in terms of magnitude and scope and rarity, but it had also been part of a larger problem, one I hadn't even realized was there. At any given conference, I meet people who have lost someone close to them. Some of them come from families riddled through the generations with suicide, violent behavior, addiction, or other brain illnesses. Others have no known biological history at all. Many will have lost more than one close family member. Others have survived their own attempts and share their stories so others might learn. Some help the bereaved, while others work every single day to keep their loved ones or their patients alive. All of us are united under the same banner. It may be too late for the ones we have lost, but it may not be too late to save others. Even as I found solidarity in this community, I stood apart. Coming to understand Dylan's death as a suicide provided some degree of comfort for me, and I must admit part of me would have liked to stop there. But I was never foolish enough to delude myself that Dylan was the only one who had been lost on the day he took his own life. Long after I came to accept Dylan's depression and desire to die by suicide, I was still grappling with the reality of his violence. The person I saw raging on the basement tapes had been completely unrecognizable, a stranger in my son's body. This person, raised in my home, the child I believed I had imbued with my values, whom I had taught to say please and thank you and to have a firm handshake, had killed other people and planned even greater destruction. Understanding his death as a suicide was an important first step, but it was only the beginning. Chapter 17. Judgment. Journal entry, August 2003. I try to find something that gives me a sense of peace, and I can't find one thing. Not writing, drawing, nature. I feel on the edge of disaster all the time. I'm still weeping over Dylan and hating myself for what he did. The image of him on the video is plastered on my brain. I feel as if his entire life and death are unresolved, and I haven't grieved yet or put any of this into perspective. Everything I think about to comfort myself is a double-edged sword. 4 years after Columbine, the date was set for our depositions. Finally, the nameless dread that had hung over us during 4 years of our grief had crystallized into an item on the calendar. Our lawyers explained that a deposition was sworn out-of-court testimony that plaintiffs could use to gather information for a lawsuit if the claims against us progressed to a trial by jury. Tom and I and the Harrises would each spend a day answering questions before a close-knit group of bereaved parents. We would sit face-to-face with the grieving parents of the children Dylan and Eric had murdered. I would see the sorrow in their eyes and know my son was responsible for putting it there. The thought filled me with terror. I had already resigned myself to financial disaster. The media had portrayed us as wealthy, in part because my grandfather had been a successful businessman. But he'd left his estate to a charitable foundation, and our home, which looked like a massive compound from the aerial shots that appeared on TV, had been a fixer-upper. So we'd lose our home and have to declare bankruptcy. What was that in comparison to what we'd already been through? The depositions would be difficult, but once they were done, whatever the outcome, at least they'd be over. Journal entry, April 2003. Dream made me cry all the way to work. Dylan was a baby, about the size of a doll. I was trying to find a way to lay him down, but there was nowhere safe to put him. I was in a dormitory and found a room full of drawers like a morgue or mausoleum. All the women in the room had a place to put their babies, but I had neglected to put a name on a drawer for him, so there was no place to lay him down. He was tired and needed to rest, but I had not managed to make a safe place for him to go. We were already widely blamed, but the depositions would be the decisive appraisal of our competence as parents. Ultimately, our fate would rest in the hands of people who hadn't known our son and who hadn't interacted with us as a family. It didn't take an outside committee to make me feel I had failed Dylan. Each day, I cataloged hundreds of things I wished I had done differently. It seemed highly likely that we would be held responsible. On the basement tapes, Dylan and Eric were blatantly homicidal and suicidal, whipping weapons around like toys. Tom and I had recognized Dylan's room in one segment, so the weapons had been in our home at least one night. The intensity of our son's rage on the tapes made the entire family seem culpable. What could possibly be said to prove his violent tendencies had been hidden? Although it was the truth, I couldn't see how anyone would believe it. I barely believed it myself. I thought often in those days of a young woman I'd met while teaching in a program for at-risk young adults working to get GEDs. Over lunch, she'd told me a story from her childhood. A classmate kept stealing her lunch money. Tired of going hungry, she finally told her father, who threw her into an empty bathtub and beat her with his belt until she could not stand. "Don't you ever come to me because you can't handle your own business," he told her. She went to school the next day with a rake handle, which she used to beat the girl who had been stealing from her. Nobody ever bothered her again. "It was the biggest favor he ever did me," she said, openly amused by my shocked look and the sandwich I'd abandoned. I had been appalled by the story. It haunted me for years. But as we headed toward the depositions, I thought a lot about what it meant to be a good parent. At the time, I'd judged her father to be abusive. But my student had told the story with love and respect. She believed her dad had parented her appropriately, and indeed, he had prepared her for the rough environment in which they lived. Had I missed the point? Certainly, I was in no position to judge. Perhaps all of us were doing the best we could with the experience, knowledge, and resources we had. The only thing I knew for sure was that Dylan had participated in the massacre in spite of the way he had been raised, not because of it. What I didn't know was how I could possibly convey this to the families of the people he had killed. Even if I could, it would never alleviate the magnitude of their suffering. Nothing would. Our original statement of apology had been published in the newspaper, as well as the one we released on the first anniversary of the massacre. But whenever anyone we knew said anything to the press, the quote was taken out of context. We were threatened and often felt afraid. Unfortunately, our inaccessibility and failure to speak up in our own defense had led people to believe we were hiding secrets. I'd written those difficult letters to each one of the victims' families. Then I had withdrawn to spare them the painful intrusion of hearing from me, even though I wanted nothing more in the world than a connection with them. I had spoken the names of their loved ones like a mantra every day. And yet the only points of contact between us came through our lawyers or from reading about each other in the paper. I wanted to bridge that distance. I knew from studying other violent incidents that it could significantly reduce trauma if the perpetrator's family could sit down with victims to apologize in person, to cry and hug and talk. As impossible as it was to envision, acknowledging each other's humanity seemed like the best course of action. As painful as that interaction would surely be, I craved it. Eventually, I had to let that go. I was the last person who could ask for a meeting and couldn't run the risk of re-traumatizing someone by imposing myself. Each family's recovery from loss is their own. I can only say here that if speaking with or meeting me would be helpful to any of the family members of Dylan and Eric's victims, I will always be available to them. We have had some contact with a few of the victims' family members over the years, and I believe it was healing for both parties. The father of a boy who died reached out to us about a year after the tragedy. We invited him to our home in December 2001. I was stunned by his generosity of spirit and found great relief in being able to apologize to him in person for Dylan's actions and to express our sorrow for his terrible loss. We wept, shared photos, and talked about our children. When we parted, he said he didn't hold us responsible. They were the most blessed words I could have hoped to hear him say. Around the same time, the mother of one of the murdered girls asked to meet. She was forthright and kind, and I liked her immediately. We both shed a lot of tears at that meeting, but I was able to apologize and to ask questions about her daughter. I was touched she asked about Dylan and wanted to know who he was. A person of deep faith, this mother feels her daughter's death was predestined and nothing could have been done to prevent it. I have told her I wish I could agree with her, but I felt a great relief to meet her and believe she took comfort from it too. I received a lovely note from the sister of a murdered girl, who wrote that she didn't think parents were responsible for the actions of their children. We also received a lovely, sad letter from Dave Sanders' granddaughter. She said she did not hate us or hold us responsible. I treasured both those letters and returned to them time and again for solace. 4 years after the depositions, 8 years after the massacre, I would meet another father whose son was murdered at the school. But at the time we were deposed, I had met only 2 people who had lost children at the school, and 36 families were making claims against us. As the day approached, I had no idea what to expect or who would be there when we faced each other in the courtroom. Journal entry, July 2003. Still struggling with fear, anxiety, and feelings of craziness. There is no safe place to park my overburdened mind. I feel frightened, beaten, and on the brink of crossing over a line to madness and not coming back. I'm constantly aware of myself, thinking about my state of mind and about death. I was okay until these damn panics started. I was making it okay. Now I'm afraid I'll never be okay again. The pressure mounted as the date of the depositions approached. Over dinner one night, Tom and I had a long conversation about the afterlife. I worried a great deal about Dylan, even after his death. I was terrified his spirit would not be allowed to rest in peace because of his crimes. It was hard enough to know Dylan had suffered in life. I could not bear the idea that he continued to suffer in death, too. As we were getting into bed, I had a debilitating panic attack. It was not the first panic attack I had ever experienced. I had been a nervous, fearful child, prone to late-night anxiety, but that night's attack was the worst I'd ever had. My thoughts spiraled out of control, and I trembled and cried as my mind pitched in terror. Those panic attacks lasted through the time of the depositions and beyond. They would strike without warning, at the hardware store, in a meeting at work, while I was driving in the car. Like a tsunami, a sudden overpowering surge of blinding fear would rise up in front of me, then crash down. These floods of incapacitating terror were worse by far than the grief. Sometimes the attacks would run into each other one after another, and I'd lose hours, even whole afternoons. I drank gallons of chamomile tea, tried every homeopathic remedy for anxiety I could find at the health food store. I was terrified I would not be able to get through my deposition, and tortured myself with imagining what would happen if I had an anxiety attack while on the stand. Reading my journals from that period is revealing to me now. It is clear on every single page that I am hanging on by a thread. I am not allowed to talk about what happened during the depositions, except to say it was terribly painful and, I believe, unsatisfying for everyone involved. I can, however, share a regret. I wanted to apologize to the families in person at the depositions, but our lawyers didn't agree. This isn't the time or place, I was told. I wish I had fought harder to say those words. I believe their absence was deeply felt by everyone in the room, and continues to be to this day. Saying I am profoundly sorry is one of the reasons I wanted to write this book. Neuroscientists like to say behavior is the result of a complex interaction between nature and nurture. At some time in the future, we will likely be able to point to the specific combination of neurotransmitters that lead a person to commit acts of unspeakable violence. I will personally rejoice on the day neurobiologists map the precise mechanism in the brain responsible for empathy and for conscience. Needless to say, we're not yet there. We do know from researchers like Dr. Victoria Arango that there are clear brain differences between people who die by suicide and people who do not. Dr. Kent Keel and others have demonstrated that there also appear to be some clear brain differences between people who commit homicide and people who do not. I have spent a lot of time wondering whether Dylan had a biological predisposition toward violence, and if so, whether or not we were responsible. I did not consume alcohol while I was pregnant with Dylan. He was not abused in our home, physically, verbally, or emotionally, nor was he subjected to anyone else being abused. He was not raised in poverty or exposed, to my knowledge, to toxins such as heavy metals, which have been connected to violent behavior. Neither of his parents abused alcohol or drugs. He was well-nourished. Even if Dylan did have a biological predisposition toward violence, biology isn't destiny. What forces had aggravated this tendency in him? The governor of Colorado cited parenting as a causal factor in his first public appearance after the shootings. But Tom and I knew exactly what had happened in our home all those years we parented Dylan, and we were equally sure the answer wasn't there. This was what I wanted to say in the depositions, not because I had any thought of clearing our names or setting the record straight, but because it was such a crucial opportunity to broaden our understanding of how tragedies like Columbine happen. Dylan did not learn violence in our home. He did not learn disconnection or rage or racism. He did not learn a callous indifference to human life. This I knew. I wanted to say that Dylan had been loved. I loved him while I was holding his pudgy hand on our way to get frozen yogurt after kindergarten, while reading Dr. Seuss's exuberant, "There's a Walket in my pocket," to him for the thousandth time, while scrubbing the grass stains out of the knees of his pint-sized Little League uniform so he could wear it to pitch the next day. I loved him while we were sharing a bowl of popcorn and watching Flight of the Phoenix together a month before he died. I still loved him. I hated what he had done, but I still loved my son. Morality, empathy, ethics, these weren't one-time lessons, but embedded in everything we did with our kids. I'd taught the boys what I myself believe, that we should treat others as we wish to be treated. Dylan was expected to help our neighbors with their yard work, without the expectation of payment, because that's what neighbors do. and to hold the door open for the person coming in behind him, because that's what gentlemen do. I'm a teacher by constitution. Everything I knew and cared about and valued, I poured into my kids. A trip to the grocery store wasn't merely a stopover to restock the fridge, but a way to show my boys how to select the freshest apple, an invitation to think about the hard-working farmers who had grown it, and to talk about the ways fruits and vegetables make a growing body healthy and strong. It was a chance for me to introduce the vocabulary words carmine and vermilion. I showed Dylan how to be gentle putting the fruit into the basket. We let an elderly lady with one or two items slip ahead of us in line. We made eye contact and said a polite thank you to the cashier. Nervous about inattentive drivers, I would take his hand when we went to tuck our shopping cart back into its spot so it couldn't roll out and dent someone else's car. My approach changed slightly as the boys grew, but the message never did. Driving home from Little League, I tried to counterbalance the sport's natural message of competition with one of empathy. The kids on the other team are just like you. Dylan came to work with me whenever the opportunity arose, and though I never saw the students I worked with as teaching moments, he learned better than most kids and through exposure that people were more than their cerebral palsy or their amputated limb. He saw, too, that even after terrible difficulty, people could create meaningful and productive lives. Similarly, Tom had worked to help his boys become good men. Through sports, he helped them understand fair play, the importance of a heartfelt effort, and the pleasure of teamwork. Working with them on repairs, he taught them science and engineering and construction, as well as the satisfaction in solving a challenging problem, not to mention the thrift and gratification of fixing something broken instead of throwing it away. He prompted them to do their chores without complaining and helped them to remember me on special occasions like Mother's Day. We had not done everything right. The research I have done has taught me better ways I might have interacted with Dylan. I wish I had listened more instead of lecturing. I wish I had sat in silence with him instead of filling the void with my own words and thoughts. I wish I had acknowledged his feelings instead of trying to talk him out of them, and that I'd never accepted his excuses to avoid conversation. I'm tired, I have homework to do, when something felt off. I wish I'd sat in the dark with him and repeated my concerns when he dismissed them. I wish I'd dropped everything else to focus on him, probed and prodded more, and that I had been present enough to see what I did not. Even with these regrets, there were no obvious indications he was planning something destructive. I have heard many terrible stories of good people struggling to parent seriously ill, violent kids. I have nothing but compassion for them, and feel we must rehabilitate a healthcare system that too often leaves them out in the cold. If you want to feel sick to your stomach, listen to a mom tell you about the day her volatile 10-year-old narrowly missed stabbing her with the kitchen shears, and how it felt to call the police on him because she was worried the lock on his younger sister's bedroom door wouldn't hold against his rage. Too often, parents of seriously disturbed kids are forced to get the criminal justice system involved, even though it is drastically ill-equipped to manage brain illness, simply because there is nowhere else to turn. Unless a family can afford a private clinic, the choice is often between denying the severity of the problem and calling the cops. The question of accountability is not theoretical for those mothers. As huge as my empathy is for those mothers, my situation was very different. Dylan showed no clear and present danger the way some children do. He was going to school, holding down a job in the evening, and applying to colleges. Days before the massacre, he was eating dinner with us as usual, keeping the conversation light, and carrying his dirty dishes to the sink. He did hole up in his room, but he hadn't withdrawn from his peers. He did not have access to weapons in our home, nor did he display any unseemly fascination with them. He was occasionally truculent and irritable, as many teenagers are, but we never saw any hint of the rage he displayed on the basement tapes. He did not threaten us, get into physical altercations, or allude to plans to hurt others. Neither Tom nor I had ever, not once, felt afraid of him. We thought we saw evidence our parenting was working. Dylan was a good and loyal friend, a loving son, and he appeared to be growing into a responsible adult. In his writing, there is ample proof that he had absorbed the teachings we had worked so hard to impart. His journals are filled with his struggles with conscience, and yet, at the end of his life, something overwrote the lessons we had taught him. Not all influence comes from within the home, and this is especially true in the case of teenagers. Nurture refers to all the environmental factors a person encounters. Dylan was interested in gratuitously bloodthirsty movies like Reservoir Dogs and Natural Born Killers, but so was every boy we knew. We did not buy those movies or take him to the theater to see them. We also did not forbid them in our home after he reached the age of 17, figuring he would get access to them if he wanted to. He was working and had his own money. We did talk to him about our concerns. He also played Doom, one of the earliest first-person shooter games. I hadn't liked the game, but I'd mostly worried that Dylan's computer use would isolate him, which hadn't been the case at all. My primary complaint about video games was how dumb they were, a waste of time. As with everything, my take on video games was filtered through my primary belief in Dylan's goodness. It would never have crossed my mind that he was capable of making the leap from shooting people on screen to shooting them in real life. Looking back, that was a mistake. There is good research now to show that violent games like Doom decrease empathy and increase aggressive behavior. Detractors point out that millions play these games, an estimated 10 million people have played Doom, and only a tiny fraction of those go on to commit violence. But Dr. Dewey Cornell, a forensic clinical psychologist and author of more than 200 papers on psychology and education, including studies of juvenile homicide, school safety, bullying, and threat assessment, gave me his take on entertainment violence. One cigarette won't give you lung cancer. And some people smoke their whole lives without getting lung cancer. That doesn't mean there's no correlation. Entertainment violence may not be sufficient cause for a rampage, but it is a toxic factor. A small number of the most vulnerable people will get lung cancer after smoking, when other factors and predispositions come into play. The same thing can be said about violent entertainment and acts of violence. The most vulnerable are at special risk. But Tom and I did not perceive Dylan as vulnerable, nor did anyone else. Dylan's vulnerabilities were probably the same ones that had made him so susceptible to Eric, another toxic influence. I was blind to it because I never perceived Dylan to be a follower. He was agreeable by nature. A typical younger sibling, he'd go along with Byron's games when the boys were young, and Tom and I could generally get him to do what we needed him to do without pushback. But I had plenty of opportunity to observe Dylan with his friends, and those relationships were equally negotiated. I never felt Zach or Nate had the upper hand with him. If Nate had a hankering for pizza while Dylan was craving McDonald's, they worked it out. I still resist the idea that Dylan was nothing more than a passive follower. Eric's charm and charisma were undeniable, and he was adroitly fooling adults, some of them mental health professionals, including a counselor and a psychiatrist. And yet, I cannot easily explain how Dylan turned his back on 17 years of empathy and conscience. Eric may have been the one who was single-mindedly focused on homicide, but Dylan went along. He did not say no. He did not tell us about the plan, or tell a teacher or one of his other friends. Instead, he said yes and entered into a plot so diabolical it defies description. I will never know why Dylan latched on to the violence, Eric suggested. His journals make clear that Dylan was profoundly insecure and felt hopelessly inadequate. Eric probably made him feel validated and accepted and powerful in a way nobody else did, and then offered him the chance to show the world just how powerful the two of them really were. Dr. Adam Lankford cites a desire for fame, glory, or attention as a motive for mass shooters. Ralph Larkin calls it killing for notoriety. Mark Juergensmeyer, who writes about religious terrorism, calls it the public performance of violence, and argues that acts like these have symbolic as well as strategic goals. Sociologist Dr. Catherine Newman, author of Rampage, ties it directly to image rehabilitation when she says school shooters are searching for a way to retire their public image as dweebs and misfits, exchanging it for something more alluring, the dangerous, violent anti-hero. I was surprised not to be asked in the depositions the details of how we'd handled discipline, movies, video games, Dylan's friendships, drugs and alcohol, clothing, firecrackers. But an in-depth look at the root causes of the catastrophe was outside the purview of the proceedings. The depositions were not a place to talk about bullying or gun safety or school climate or the immaturity of the adolescent brain. I had not yet begun to talk to experts myself. Even at that early stage, though, I was clear on one point. I did not and do not believe I made Dylan a killer. If I had thought there was something seriously wrong with him, I would have moved mountains to fix it. If I had known about Eric's website or the guns or about Dylan's depression, I would have parented differently. As it was, I parented the best way I knew to parent the child I knew, not the one he had become without my knowledge. Unsurprisingly, the news reports after the depositions were highly inflammatory, as so much of the coverage had been. The sealed transcripts of the proceedings gave the impression we were hiding something, again. I wanted to share the transcripts with the public. Why not? I was tired of fielding the implication I had something to hide when I spent my days hunting for answers. Perhaps naively, I still hoped releasing the transcripts might finally put to bed the idea there was a single reason the tragedy had happened. And unlike the basement tapes, there was no danger of contagion from releasing them. Unfortunately, it wasn't my decision. All four parents of the shooters had been deposed, and the attorneys never reached consensus on everyone's best interests. Eventually, the judge decided to seal the depositions for 20 years. I hadn't said everything I wanted to say when I was deposed, but I thought if the families could see and hear me, they'd understand that whatever the engine for Dylan's crimes had been, it had not started in our home. The papers the next morning showed me my folly. There it was again. Conscientious parents would have known what their sons were planning. Our failure to know meant we were responsible. Nothing would ever change how people perceived us. I shredded the newspaper in my hands and pounded the bed with my fists until my wailing subsided. Hurt as I was, I also understood. I, too, had believed a good parent should know what her kids were thinking. If the situations had been reversed, if someone else's son had murdered Dylan while he was catching up on his homework in the school library, I would have blamed that family, too. I continued to experience high levels of stress, loss of sleep, and poor concentration after the depositions. 10 days afterward, we heard that the plaintiffs were ready to settle. The lawyers acted as if this was a great relief, but I didn't feel the least bit uplifted. No legal resolution would alleviate the dread that sat in the center of my chest, the hopeless feeling that I had reached the end of my ability to cope. With medication and therapy, my panic attacks eventually subsided. We went back to our lives, continuing to learn to live without Dylan and with the knowledge of what he had done. Chapter 18. The Wrong Question. Grief has a life cycle. Many people have told me they started to emerge from the fog after about 7 years, and that was true for me as well. By 2006, I was starting to feel better. I did not miss Dylan any less, and an hour did not pass where I did not think with pain and sadness about his victims and their families. But I wasn't crying every day, or wandering through the world like a zombie. With the legal restrictions lifted, I began to wonder if I could help promote a better understanding of suicide by speaking out. Through my work in suicide prevention, I'd met two other survivors of murder-suicide. It had helped us to talk to one another. Most suicide loss survivors struggle with grief, guilt, and humiliation, but when a family member commits murder in the last moments of his life, it changes him in your mind and alters the way you grieve for him. You never stop asking if something you did caused him to behave as he did. The media attention can be traumatizing. These other survivors of murder-suicide believed, as I did, that suicide had been a driving factor behind their loss. And yet the public persisted in seeing these acts exclusively as murders. We wanted to show that murder-suicide is a manifestation of suicide, and to help people to understand that suicide prevention is also murder-suicide prevention. So when I found out the University of Colorado at Boulder was hosting a conference called Violence Goes to College, I decided to organize a panel discussion on murder-suicide. Tom had found my immersion in the suicide prevention and loss community depressing, and he felt even more strongly about my murder-suicide research. He called our panel the Adams Family. I think he thought I was refusing to move on, and I sometimes wondered if he was right. I amassed a library of books about the adolescent brain, about suicide, murder-suicide, and the biology of violence, seeking out inconvenient truths and uncomfortable realities. Part of it, perhaps, was penance. Another part, self-protection. If I sought out the very worst, then it could never catch me unawares. Underneath it all, though, there was simply a compulsion to understand. How could Dylan, raised in our home, have done this? I wanted to claim Dylan as my son. I wanted to stand up and tell people that as much grief and regret as I felt for those he had hurt and killed, he was still loved. Unfortunately, I wasn't yet ready. In the weeks leading up to my appearance on the panel, I went with a friend to see her daughter perform in a play at her college. It should have been a beautiful weekend, but being on campus with all those young people triggered something inside me. It was the first time I'd visited a college campus since I'd been to the University of Arizona with Dylan, and whenever I saw a tall, skinny boy enjoying college life, my heart would clutch. Walking across the beautiful campus, I was jolted by a severe panic attack, my first since the spell I'd had during the depositions. I had another during the play we'd come to see, and another over dinner. Flipping through the channels in my hotel room while I was waiting for my friends to pick me up the next morning, I landed on I'll Cry Tomorrow, the 1955 biopic of singer Lillian Roth. During Susan Hayward's portrayal of Roth's alcohol-induced nervous breakdown, I had a panic attack so acute I thought it would kill me. That weekend began a terrible period. It was as if my brain had an accelerator spring stuck in the floored position. In previous periods of panic, I had focused on death, but this time I thought about fear. I became afraid of being afraid. Anything could trigger an attack. Driving past the coroner's office where they'd taken Dylan's body, boom. Watching an old movie where a cowboy throws dynamite into a barn, boom. Red flowers on a bush, boom. My digestive system has always been my Achilles heel, and I became afraid to eat because of the constant intestinal upsets that came with the panic. Because the attacks were triggered by anything that reminded me of Dylan's death, my therapist felt they were a manifestation of post-traumatic stress disorder. She was clear about my course of treatment. I needed to take the tranquilizers a doctor had prescribed. but I was afraid of becoming addicted to them, and so I'd only take half a pill or a quarter, enough to dull the edge of my anxiety, but not enough to give me a true sense of well-being or to allow my racing mind to rest. Underneath it all, I